Coming up today, the censorship of pornography in Britain was in the news this week, so naturally we've got to talk about why. Plus, Facebook's acquisition of Oculus Rift last week caused the founders to receive death threats. We examine why this keeps happening in gaming. And did you know it's still technically illegal to copy a music CD into your iTunes library? Well, good news, law fans, it's not going to be for long. All that, plus the debate around ethnically diverse emoticons coming up, along with your feedback. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting from science and tech to pornography and whether you should copy that floppy. I'm your host, Nate Langson. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Olivia underscore Solon.
And I'm Liat Clark.
And we, collectively, as in Liat, Liv and Nate, currently the 36th most popular podcast in the UK. Not just in tech, all podcasts. That is quite nice. Thank you, friends, for listening.
That's awesome. Let's make it 35th.
Yes, well, it might be by the time.
Why not first, guys? Come on.
I know, at the time of recording. But we're very, very grateful for all the attention and receive. We're about five or six places behind Answer Me This.
Is that who you see as our key rival?
No, not really. No, it's only because Ollie is sort of an extended friend of the show. I think okay. He listens, and I like their show.
Watch out, Ollie.
But now, the news. Liat.
Nate.
Porn correspondent, quite often these days.
Yes, I get very excited about
porn. Fair enough. What was exciting you this week? Law and porn. Porn law.
I get concerned about our right to watch porn. So I don't know if you saw, but last week, ATVOD, which is the regulator for TV on demand, wrote a report urging the government to change the law so that it can block any online pornography sites that fail to pay for a license and use age verification techniques such as credit cards. So I spoke to a number of people, obviously concerned about my porn watching capabilities being altered.
But it's not yours, is it? It's to stop kids getting...
Exactly. It's concerns around the moral development of our under 18s. Mm. So I spoke to some lawyers, I spoke to some campaigners, and there appears to be a bit of a sense that this won't work and is legally complex to actually enforce. One specific campaigner, Jerry Barnett, he's the founder of Sex and Censorship, was pretty outspoken, really. He basically suggested that ATVOD is trying to justify its own existence by creating work for itself. And if you think about porn, guys, just think about it for a minute.
Okay, thanks for that.
There's quite a lot. So they really would, be making quite a bit of dollar.
But I think that the problem is that a lot of these pornography sites are not hosted in the UK.
Exactly.
Which means that they have to conform to certain laws to operate here, but it's probably quite difficult to enforce.
Absolutely. That's why they want the government to create this law, because it's basically a similar law to what's kind of going through now for gambling sites, which addresses that problem that most are outside of the UK. ATVOD has already kind of targeted a lot of sites based in the UK, and a number of them have either had to close or change their business model to basically survive in the business. But most online pornography, it comes from outside the UK. So that's why they're addressing it this way. And the way they actually are empowered to do this is under a European directive, which is why the US in particular might be irked by this. And the directive basically says that they have the responsibility to ensure age verification is in place for any TV on demand services that might impair the physical, mental or moral development of an under 18.
Yeah, because they've made a big song and dance about the fact that there are some kids as young as six watching porn. But actually, we're talking about teenagers, really. The vast majority of the people who are so far accessing it, who this will try and protect, are actually people who are going to very easily get round any age restriction anyway.
Absolutely. I think most of the headlines that came out were like, 6-year-olds are watching porn. And when you read it, it's like 6% of 6-year-olds or something, you know, from a survey that's extrapolated these figures from a smaller cross-section.
What 6-year-olds are watching pornography?
Well, I think that it happens accidentally, probably. They're probably watching dad watch porn.
Oh, I see.
But no, they apparently, you know, monitored browsing history for 45,000 under 18s. AtVod, for its part, says, the law doesn't allow for us to specify, you know, a 6 to 15-year-old. The law is for under 18s, so it has to be this kind of blanket rule.
So what counts as porn then, without going into great detail? Because there's erotic content. Mm. There is obviously flat-out porn that anyone would say is pornography. What about that sort of weird grey area where it's might be an X-rated film, but we're seeing a lot of 18-rated films now that have unsimulated sex in them.
I think that's
Lars von Trier's New Nymphomaniac and Nine Songs, Michael Winterbottom, I think.
Okay, yeah. Well,
so is that porn? Because it's not designed to arouse, but it is actual penetrative intercourse and what have you.
I think there's areas which are okay, like if you have real sex for an educational video, you know, the BBFC, the British Board Film Classification, isn't going to stamp it on that. And I think likely, I mean, that could be an R18, but it wasn't in the UK, that film, was it? It wasn't classed R.
Which one?
The Nymphomaniac.
It was, I believe it's an 18.
Yeah, so yeah. I think anything that falls into kind of hardcore pornography, including penetration and images of real sex, is R18. Mm. And that's where a lot of these bodies take their standard from, even though they tell me they don't. Because it says in their report.
This is where the moral police comes in and has to draw a line somewhere. Although I have to say, I think that in my experience, it's pretty clear what's a porn site and what is a movie site that is hosting content that may arouse. Mm. And there is a clear distinction. You know, I think you know perfectly well if you go on, I don't know, the BFI's website that has all sorts of stuff on there, or you go to Pornhub, it's pretty clear which one needs the heavier hand played in terms of restricting access, I think.
But there are different degrees.
Somebody has to make that call. And
but the question is, should it be the government or should it be parents?
Yeah,
parents. I think
isn't actually even the government. This is, a
random
body
regulator
that has been out. You know, the government is basically outsourcing their decision on all these things.
Well, let us know what you think. podcast@wired.co.uk. Two questions for you to answer, which we'll read out some answers to next week. A, should we be putting age restrictions up front on pornographic websites? And if so, or even if not so, how best should we do so? Or what's the alternative? Let us know. podcast@wired.co.uk. Last week, we talked about Facebook buying Oculus Rift, or specifically Oculus VR, the company that makes Oculus Rift, the wearable virtual reality headset that's been used a lot in gaming. Now, we were quite excited by this. We thought it's an interesting acquisition. It buys the company a lot more development time, being under the wing of Mark Zuckerberg and his many dollars. And but based on immediate reaction, you would have probably thought that a death sentence for the acquisition was a bit extreme, but that is exactly what has happened, unfortunately. Some particularly vitriolic commenters have felt comfortable enough with suggesting that a death sentence should extend not only to the creators of the technology, but also their families. Oculus founder Palmer Luckey said in a Reddit post at the weekend, quote, "We expected to receive this sort of reaction from people in the short term, but we did not expect to be getting so many death threats and harassing phone calls that extended to our family. Or families. We know we will prove ourselves with actions and not words, but that kind of shit is unwarranted, especially since it is impacting people who have nothing to do with Oculus."
Absolutely. It's also terrifying that these people are going to the trouble to track down their family members' phone numbers or, you know,
passionate
personal details.
Passionate people. Morons, but passionate ones. So elsewhere in the Reddit thread, Luckey had said that the initial reaction wasn't really surprising, but still obviously felt it was kind of undeserved from his point of view. And again, quote, "We expected a knee-jerk reaction from people who don't have all the information we do and will not have it for some time. We expected a negative reaction, but that does not mean we think the reaction is warranted. My primary goal is the long-term success of VR, not short-term warm and fuzzy feelings." Now, the reason that this is such an important story, not only because anyone who has sent a death threat for a company being acquired by another company is a moron, if you're listening and you've sent one, turn off the podcast. We don't want you as a listener. You're an idiot and you should be slapped. But it does seem to be a recurring theme.
In gaming.
Mm. A couple of other examples, of, just from recent memory, Dong Nguyen, who was the guy who created Flappy Bird, pulled the game because he felt it was too addictive. And he was getting a huge number of death threats, apparently, from people who thought that the game was wrongfully pulled and, you know, all sorts of reasons. Huge amounts of abuse that led him, you know, to pull the game, although to recently decide to put it back as well. And then it was big news last year when a senior writer on Dragon Age, the EA fantasy game, Jennifer Hepler, decided to leave BioWare, the company that made the game, after, quote, graphic threats were made to kill her children. The game was unpopular with a lot of hardcore fans, although I have to say I really enjoyed the game. And although Hepler was able to ignore, I think, most of the abuse on forums and Twitter and things, she got death threats via email and abusive phone calls. And obviously threats against her is one thing, but threats against her and her kids is entirely, well, not entirely different, but it certainly raises the extremity. So this is really, really bad and keeps happening in gaming.
Yeah.
But I think it's anything that's supremely popular, this happens. I mean, on a very small scale, we see that when a story we publish gets a lot of attention, some vitriolic stuff will come out. And obviously, gaming has such a vast, you know, popularity and people very, very passionate about it, you're going to get some crazies.
But it's just complete idiots. I mean,
yeah, they're idiots, but I mean, I think this isn't just gaming, this is just society.
What do you achieve by doing this? I mean, I know that that's kind of stating the obvious, but do you think that people who have sold their business to Facebook are going to suddenly unsell it? Or, you know, people who have,
It's people who live in their own weird little fantasy world. They probably... I think a lot of them probably don't realize the gravity of what they're saying. Mm. I think there's a lot of younger, ill-informed, less worldly kids who don't necessarily think that what they're saying has the effect that it can, particularly en masse. And nothing actually tends to come of these. I mean, it's one thing to get death threats and this all sort of stuff. And we did a big feature last year on a couple of podcasts about rape threats and things to women on Twitter. But it doesn't actually happen. Or at least it's reported a lot more that the threats are there more than it's actually happened. No one's actually been killed here. And that does also seem to be the other trend, is that these are idle threats. They're made to provoke, to make someone uncomfortable, to make their feelings of disappointment as obvious as is possible, but with a filter of moral code removed that means I'm angry, I'm super pissed off, I don't like what you've done, this is terrible, even if it's written with obscenities and F words and all sorts of stuff, is still better than I'm going to kill your children for this.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if we'll have seen more countries, you know, kind of solidifying the legal terminology around this, like, you know, like the cases we've had in the UK with the rape threats. There's been much more of a focus on how and when it's appropriate to actually, you know, go to Twitter and demand that you have someone identified because they've made a serious threat.
Hmm.
Because presumably none of these threats have ever been followed up.
No, I've had it before now. Someone once said that it might not be the worst idea if I killed myself after suggesting that the Opera guys should stop making the desktop web browser.
Wow.
A few years
There's
ago.
There's a cause to get behind.
Yeah. I didn't. Sorry to disappoint you.
One of the biggest threats we've seen, at least documented, was when we had the One Direction guys on the front of GQ.
Yes.
Do you remember? And this was teenage girls largely, let's face
it. That's
different. But they had some of the most creative and vitriolic, unpleasant ways with which they could kill you using bleach in various orifices and glass in various other ones.
One Direction fans are, in our experience, bonkers.
I told a guy in a shop at Christmas I'd never heard one of their songs. I didn't know any of them. And he literally nearly threw me out. He was a teenager. He was like, have you been living under a rock?
Okay, anyway, let us know what you think about this. Obviously, we've talked about quite a lot of this with death threats. But why do you think it keeps happening? Have we hit the nail on the head? Are we missing something? Have you sent a death threat? Let us know. Podcast at wired.co.uk. Liv, African SMS money transfer system makes leap to Europe. That's a headline we published this week.
It is indeed.
This got my excitement juices juicier.
Yeah, this is about a tool called M-Pesa, which actually allows anyone with a mobile phone to withdraw, deposit and transfer money using just text message. And it completely bypasses the banking system. I think it launched in Kenya initially, and it allowed people who'd never been able to get a bank account to actually transfer money in a very efficient way. So how it works is you go into a kiosk, you buy credit, and then you transfer the details to a friend via SMS, and then you can go into another kiosk, or they can go into another kiosk and pick up that cash. So you do not need to have a bank account. All you need to have is a mobile phone, or at least a shared mobile phone you have access to, and you can, you know, work in one place and transfer money elsewhere. Now, it hasn't launched in Europe because it's mostly been a tool used by people who don't have that much access to banking. So it's traditionally worked best in developing markets. But it has just moved to Romania. And this is because most Romanians have mobile phones, but there are still a third of the population that does not have a bank account.
It seems like these are the sorts of scenarios that this kind of service works, where people aren't using smartphones, aren't using traditional banks.
Yeah.
That's why I don't necessarily think it's perfect for use in the UK.
No, but
I mean, I think something like 60% of Africa's GDP goes through M-Pesa, yeah. I think. More than half.
I think the interesting thing is that it bypasses the banking system. And I was thinking about this. Obviously, we, you know, most people in the UK do have access to banking. But I wonder how this could be used in terms of kind of almost money laundering capabilities.
Yeah. How you can move avoiding tax.
Avoid tax. How can you move money around? It's the same way that you'd hand over a wad of cash to someone. This is kind of equivalent, although Vodafone, who own M-Pesa, would have the logs, presumably.
It reminds me of Bitcoin.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So is this an easier way of accessing something like Bitcoin without having to get heavily involved?
It could be. I could see it being used. I mean, we talked about this last week a little bit almost about donations to charity via SMS and the complications that can occur if you type the wrong word and send it to the same charity, and you find you're sponsoring, you know, sad cats instead of cancer research. And I could see this being employed for something like this, for charities. You know, friend to friend, peer to peer lending.
But then we already have things like Pingit, which do that, but then that requires a bank account with Barclays in that case.
So they're bringing it here?
No, they're bringing it to Romania, and they're starting with 300 Vodafone stores, and then they're going to expand to 2,000 locations. Not clear on what the next market will be after Romania, but I'm sure they will find another one in the near future.
Are you in Romania? Let us know if you're excited. Podcast at wired.co.uk. Super quick little postscript to the news section. A new version of Spotify, big, fat, complete overhaul, went live today, the day of recording. I went over to Stockholm about a week ago to see Spotify and to get the big backstory on this redesign, why it looks the way it does, what they did, some of the technology behind it, meet the people who designed it, all sorts of stuff like that. So you may well have seen the new version in your App Store updates or on your desktop client and what have you. It's a really massive change, I think, for the company, and it's a very different look and feel. And so I thought we would mention that. And if you are a Spotify user and would like to understand the backstory to how and why the client was redesigned and what they've done and what they're trying to do differently now, then go to wired.co.uk, search for Spotify redesign. You'll find my feature, and hint, hint, it's the first of at least two. Something else is coming soon, so keep your eye out for that. And also, coincidentally, the cover story of the new Wired, the magazine version, the print version of wired.co.uk, has Daniel Ek on the cover. He is in our Wired 100 list, and that goes on sale on Thursday the 3rd of April, which is basically now. So that's on sale right now. Still to come, we're going to find out why it's been illegal to rip CDs, but why it's about to not be.
Do you want a free audiobook? You probably do, since you're listening to our podcast. Audible.co.uk is offering every listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast any book from its catalogue of 80,000, including the latest science, technology and business releases from best-selling authors, just for trying out its service. A one-month trial of audible.co.uk costs nothing, and whatever book you choose to download is yours to keep, even if you cancel your account. Head to audible.co.uk/wired, where you can sign up in a few seconds to download any book you want. You'll be supporting Nate, Olivia, Liat, and the rest of the Wired.co.uk podcast team. And you get a free book in return. Sign up easily now at audible.co.uk/wired. Thanks for supporting the show. That's audible.co.uk/wired.
Welcome back. One of our most popular segments for one of two segments in the second half of this week's show. Buckle up, we're riding the Technosaurus. This week, the Technosaurus has been crushing laws. Crushing laws that have been existent for a long time, and most people don't know about the law, and certainly don't care, and now don't need to, because as of the 1st of June 2014, it will no longer be illegal to make copies of CDs, or ebooks, or other media, that you have bought for personal use. Sudden outbreak of common sense raining down onto UK heads everywhere.
About 15 years too late.
About 15 years too late, yes. Funny how UK law works. It might sound surprising, but according to British current law, and still we're not in June yet, so it is technically still illegal, it is actually illegal to copy a CD for backup or to play music on an MP3 player, for example, or mobile. It's also illegal to format shift an ebook you bought from one device to another. So if you wanted to, say, download something on a Sony e-reader and format it so it then works on a Kindle or something like that, technically that's illegal, but from the 1st of June, it will not be. And that's because of a change under the new exceptions to copyright law, which were first initiated by a 2011 Hargreaves review, I believe. And basically, people will no longer be committing a crime by format shifting copies of CDs, books, and films and things. Now, there are some bad news items for you freeloaders out there. It will still remain illegal to make copies at home for friends and family, unless you get rid of your original personal copy, then it's okay. And intriguingly, the Intellectual Property Office says that if anti-copying technology, that's DRM in Wired nerd parlance, is too restrictive, then consumers can raise a complaint with the Secretary of State. And if a user complains that they cannot benefit from the exception, that is, that it's now legal to copy for personal use, due to a technological measure, the Secretary of State is empowered to, quote, give directions to copyright owners to enable the complainant to benefit. That is to say that if a movie studio may be forced to make it easier for individuals to copy their DVDs and Blu-rays for personal use.
That's kind of hilarious.
That's a summary and a half, wasn't it?
Because all these companies that have been working under the assumption that it's been illegal for all this time, and they've just like got their model for doing it this way, are going to immediately be told they're not allowed to do that at the same time.
I spoke to the IP. They weren't saying that they were going to be forced to make it really easy to copy. It's more that if it was impossible to copy and there were no other easily accessible alternatives in digital format, then they might do it. But the DRM is actually mainly about stopping people from pirating and selling copies, as opposed to,
which works super effectively.
Obviously, but you know, I can see why they would want to have those protection measures in place, whether or not you think it's a good idea to have it in DRM format.
It was really great. There was a Kickstarter campaign for a film called a program. I can't remember what it's called now. This is so annoying. Basically, a really popular sci-fi type geek culture film that was funded on Kickstarter. And the backers, they backed it, it got made. And then the studio, I think it was Warner Brothers, had fulfilled their deal and said everyone gets a copy of the film once it gets made. And that's fine. It was sent in their ultraviolet DRM format that can be viewed on the Flickster mobile app, which meant that the backers had supported this campaign and then had this super restrictive DRM'd version of their movie, while everyone who didn't back the campaign was just able to go onto BitTorrent or what have you and just download it without these restrictions and use it wherever they want. And I think the studio had to give them the money back.
Veronica Mars,
thank you. Sorry. That's what happens when you riff off notes, which is a real problem. We just know that DRM does not do anything but harm legitimate consumers. Now, there's some interesting other angles to this story. For libraries and museums, for example, the changes mean that institutions can make digital copies of any works held in their permanent collection for preservation purposes, as long as it's not reasonably practical to purchase a replacement. There's also some good news for non-commercial researchers as well, who should be able to make copies of copyrighted materials for private study, and this does include DVDs, pictures, books, plays, and artworks. Again, copying has to be reasonable and proportionate. So, you know, this means, it doesn't mean that students can copy an entire DVD for quote-unquote research purposes instead of paying for the download or something.
Well, I'm not sure how you police that, but again, let that one slide.
I'm sure libraries and museums have hopefully been doing this for years anyway.
But this is the daft thing. I mean, since the early 2000s, Apple had promoted iTunes with the quote, rip, mix, burn. Mm. You know, rip your CDs, mix up the tracks, burn a playlist onto a blank CD. You know, that was kind of their main marketing hook for iTunes like over a decade ago.
But they have the fair use principle already in law in the US.
Yeah, but we don't.
Well, now we do.
We do. Good time. Just in time to help iTunes with its marketing, much as it needs it, of course. So I think what is funny, though, is that you will have to go back a long time to find anyone arrested for making copies of purchased CDs. I can't remember any time. It's sort of one of these things where the laws are there, really, as you said earlier, Liv, to kind of protect mass copies and all this sort of stuff. And I think it's probably comparable to some of those, like, we'll look at this in 50 years' time, was one of those antique laws that are still technically law, but are also completely impractical to enforce. Like, apparently it's illegal to carry a corpse in a London black cab.
How
many people do that, and why was that law in place in the first place?
Well, I think it's because, actually, I think, again, this isn't notes, I'm pretty sure this is true. You're not allowed to take a taxi if you have the plague leprosy. I think that's still law. And I think it's probably because somebody did take a corpse in a car. The car kicked them out and said, no, you can't do that. And they said, where's the law that says I can't bring a corpse in here?
Maybe someone didn't have the money to get a nice funeral car.
True.
And they just shoved it in the back.
Yeah, I don't know. It's also illegal to be in charge of a cow if you're drunk in Scotland.
That's just common sense.
Common sense. Anyway, but I think that's how we'll see these laws in future. It's kind of a weird little antique law. So anyway, let us know what you think. Are you going to celebrate on the 1st of June by copying all of your CDs? Are you going to rip something? Are you going to mix it? Are you going to burn it? or are you just going to carry on doing what you've been doing for the last 15 years because you're a practitioner of common sense? podcast@wired.co.uk. Second and final segment in part two of this week's podcast is WWWTF.
What the?
Now, in WWWTF, we like to question things that are a little bit unusual happening on the web or the internet. And this week, Liv, we're going to talk about Afro emoticons combating the lack of diversity in emoji and emoticons.
Yeah.
Wonderful little story, this.
Yeah. Miley Cyrus is not someone we tend to talk about much on the podcast, but way back in 2012, she highlighted the lack of diversity in emoji. She tweeted about it, had some hashtag about it, and then it kind of died down a little bit. And when I say diversity, I'm not talking about the yellow smileys. I'm not saying that, you know, they're not trying to say that the yellow round smiley faces are a race of any sort. But she's talking about the standard set of emojis that aren't yellow smileys are, in the large part, all white. There's one guy in a turban and there's one guy in a kind of traditional Chinese hat. But apart from that, they all look pretty Caucasian. Now, this week, an MTV journalist called Joey Parker reignited the debate and actually contacted Apple CEO Tim Cook about the issue. Now, he singled out Apple because apparently it's considered a pioneer of emojis, as well as it actually offered the full colour images first and introduced them to the American market, at least according to Parker.
I'm pretty sure MSN Messenger did that in about 2001.
I think the standard Unicode ones on the mobile space. Yeah. And so, yeah. And I guess, you know, who's going to be contacting MSN Messenger these days?
Burn.
Lol. But remarkably, he got a reply from Apple, which I think is a pretty big deal. And it wasn't directly from Tim, but it was via Katie Cotton, who was a VP in communications. And she said, we agree with you. And we're actually working with the Unicode Consortium in order to address the issue. Now, this Unicode Consortium, I said Unicode, that was the cartoon that I was talking about earlier.
Well, you're thinking of unicorns again,
aren't
you?
I am. It is about a unicorn. The Unicode Consortium is the organization that's in charge of standardizing emojis. And there's about 800 of them that are designed to be interoperable between no matter what phone you're using. So that if you send an emoji via your iPhone, your friend who's using an Android phone will get the same winky face or whatever it might be. And it might look slightly different, but there is a standardization there. So in response to all of this furore, a company called Oju Africa, which is actually a division of a mobile manufacturer called MyPhone in Africa, has launched its own range of black emojis. And they're designed for Android and will be released on iOS too. Unfortunately, they're not the standardized one, so we have to wait until Tim Cook pushes the Unicode consortium into launching standardized ones. But it's a good start.
It's a good start, but it does make me think that this could be the start of an incredibly vast set of emojis. Because if you think about it, if there's about 800 now that are primarily Caucasian in appearance, doing everything from high fives to little smiling poops to what else do you have? I suppose horses don't really count. But, you know, there's so many of these faces.
Yeah.
Are we going to replicate all of those faces for different skin tones and
isn't that 800 total?
So it's 800 in total. That includes the yellow smileys and all the horses.
So there's actually
and stuff.
Not that many, I think.
No, I think there's maybe 20 or 30 or 40 of the race one, the white faces. So there's two non-white faces, and so I think they could just do a bit better at mixing that up a bit.
I see. Good. Well, I look forward to the update on my phone.
Go Miley.
Well, that wraps up news and discussion, two-thirds of our show. We have a couple of bits of feedback we want to get to by jumping into the feedback loop. Spinning around the loop this week, we decided to pick out two. Liat, you're going to read one that came in from Edmund. We'd asked for feedback about Snowden and the ongoing debate there. We're going to let this be the last week we talk about this, but we have two.
Yes.
Don't we?
Edmund says, "Greetings from a Scot living in Frankfurt. Thanks for your show, my joint favourite, along with Stuff You Know You Should Know, which I found out through you guys, Dunkey. A lot has been said about the Snowden affair, but I think the viewpoint from the two main sides of the line are both staring too close to the trees to see the leaves. Ironically, I think one of the biggest safeguards for the average citizen's private data is the actual amount of data being gathered by GCHQ and the NSA, in the sense that GCHQ, as an example, only has finite resources and this time is probably spent on actual threat-based information, not on web searches or phone calls of the average person. People at GCHQ have jobs to do, managers to report to, and so forth up the chain. But there's a personal side that people seem to be forgetting. I lost a close friend in the Bali bombings and should have been there that night. It happened, but for a stroke of fate, I could not make it. And I say this only in that staff at GCHQ are not robots, but human beings, who are mostly British citizens with friends, family, loved ones living in the UK, as they and you do. They probably garner more of an understanding of ongoing real threats that don't make the media that would have the same consequences as that awful day in London, and therefore devote more of a professional approach to their job than we realise or even appreciate. Yes, in a perfect world, certain things should not happen, but the threat from Al-Qaeda and the like that sadly lurks in the shadows within touching distance of all of us these days calls for extraordinary measures. I personally believe as a result of the reach of an average person's Twitter, Facebook, or other social media feed, a lot of people have a rather exaggerated self-importance of what their thoughts, utterances, and pictures of their nightly dinner is actually worth. And the shock that someone could have access to their nightly dinner library results in a reaction not to warrant the weight of what their personal data is worth. Keep up the good work, and why can you not expand the podcast to an hour or longer per week? All the best ever in Frankfurt. Beers are on me.
Ed, thank you very much for such a considered and well-written email. It's a very balanced approach, and again, it's one of the reasons that we like to invite people to comment, because that's not a viewpoint that we had. And I don't think there's much more that we can really say on that topic. But just to answer your last question, the reason we don't do the podcast for an hour a week is mostly because we angle the show at being suitable for a average commute in London, which for a lot of people is about half an hour-ish door-to-door, depending on whereabouts you live. So we try and keep it to that distance. We have thought about in the past, because we do sometimes chop stories out as doing a unedited version and a sort of more concise version. Maybe we shall reconsider that.
It'd be interesting to hear what other people think, if you would like to have more of our voices in your ears or not.
Yes, we know we've got a lot of you guys out there who listen to other podcasts, so let us know. What podcast length would you like? Are we too long? Are we too short? Should we be 3 hours? like some of the gaming podcasts out there. Should it be 10 minutes? That'll never happen. Let us know, podcast@wired.co.uk. We had one more quick email we wanted to get to. Arendi wrote in, again, just to comment quickly on the Snowden stuff. We'd asked for your opinions about the revelations that were revealed at TED and things like that. And he says, it is true that in a world that has an abundance of information readily available, it's also an environment that enables good and bad at levels that were previously not obtainable without large resources. We need checks and balances in our complex societies, but to have these measured in place, available only to a select few, is a system that has no accountability. And I think that it is that last bit of Arendi's sentence that means the most, accountability. That's the problem, I think, at the moment. It's one company with all the power. Mm. Not necessarily good. Let us know what you think to anything we've talked about on today's show, podcast@wired.co.uk. And I think unless Liat or Liv can think of anything else to say, we'll return in 1 week.
Bye.
Bye.
You've finished this week's episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android, tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine.
That would make a font.
It would make religion much more interesting, wouldn't it? As if you dipped the baby into a big pool of words and letters, all different fonts, instead of putting a baby into
in
the
font.
A liquid font.
Put a baby into
Well, the font's actually stone.
Liquid.
Yes,
in the church, the font.
But you could fill the font with fonts.
Yeah.
You know.
Like,
you could be
alphabeti spaghetti.
Holy water.
You could be sans religion with sans serif.
Mm. Do you think they have to re-bless the water every time?
I've wondered that. I wonder if you, every time you bring in a fresh baby and you have to change.
Because the evil might have, like, crossed.
No, because the good overpowers the evil, doesn't it?
Yeah, but maybe it's contaminated. Yeah, I guess. But what if evil is like oil and water and it's just in there somewhere and maybe you will catch a bit?
I don't know.
Is it like homeopathy?
I think the church needs to.
Yeah, I guess I'm stronger than what diluted it is.
Exactly. So you have to get it down to a. I don't understand.
It's so weird.
Should we start a podcast?